From the Hill Country in Texas, this is OneRadioNetwork.com.
Number two of our show. This is OneRadioNetwork.com. It's an honor to be here with you. I got someone to talking about water. Didn't check our schedule for the rest of this week, but I'll get to it sometime and plug it along here as we go. Well, it's an honor to have this gentleman on the show. We talked to him, I guess about 3 years ago. 4 years ago, we put out really as a landmark book on the thyroid. Why do I still have thyroid symptoms when my lab tests are normal? In the fall of 2009, Datis Karazian, chiropractor and writer, teacher, he's in a neurology, studied nutrition. He is on the editorial board of the Journal of Functional Medicine. He teaches postgraduate non-pharmaceutical methods for chronic illnesses, autoimmune problems, neurological disorders. As patients worldwide, he's on the faculty of Bastyr University, which is like one of the premier naturopathic schools ever. And he has a new book out about the brain. Why isn't my brain working? Dr. Karazian, good morning.
Good morning.
How are you, sir?
Very good, thank you. Thank you for having me on the show.
Yeah, nice to talk to you. So this book, your thyroid book, what, 4 years ago this fall, and now your brain book, did the work with the thyroid kind of lead you into to looking at the brain and researching the brain? You have hundreds and hundreds of hours of research in this book.
Well, you know, the interesting thing was with the thyroid book was I wasn't really sure anyone would read it, but it became a number one bestseller for thyroid and endocrinology metabolism, and the positive feedback was just so amazing that I decided to continue other books. And I just felt that with the thyroid book, there was so much information that thyroid patients didn't know about and they needed to know about, because the current healthcare model, both conventional and alternative, overlooked so many basic concepts that we know are true in the research and physiology. The brain book kind of goes along the same line, because most practitioners don't know what to do with brain degenerative conditions or even how to recognize it. And I mean both alternative and conventional. In the world of neurology, unless you have progressed severe neurological disease, you don't get diagnosed, and then there's very little options for you even when you get diagnosed. And in the world of alternative medicine, most people wouldn't know how to identify early Parkinson's or dementia. And we have all these people suffering with brain-related disorders. And when the brain degenerates and starts to fail, most people will typically have digestive problems and fatigue and depression. And we have too many healthcare practitioners not being able to recognize brain-related mechanisms. So it was just this need to try to get that information out to the public and to, you know, practitioners. And that's why the brain book was written.
Interesting. So in the medical, Dr. Karazian, in the medical model, the contemporary medical model, there, these conditions, these dementia, Parkinson's, all these things aren't recognized till way down the line, are you saying? And that they can,
right,
they can, with different tests and things, you can find these things way ahead of time?
Absolutely. Huh. If you look at, for example, Parkinson's disease, there's eight different known stages, and the last stage of Parkinson's disease is when you start to have tremors.
Wow.
And the earliest sign of Parkinson's disease is when you actually lose gastrointestinal motility, so you get constipated, and you lose your ability to smell. And then you get slowness of movement. So many people start to have early stages of Parkinson's, but no one does anything for them until they end up with tremors, and at that point, the condition is so progressed that all prognosis has become very poor. With dementia, I mean, it becomes, early dementia signs are very simple. You just forget where you're going. You have to write things down, and In the current model, you have to basically forget who your family member is and lose your way home before you even get the diagnosis. And many people have early signs of Parkinson's, and many people have early signs of dementia and Alzheimer's, but they get overlooked, and they become considered personality issues, and you know, maybe mom or grandma is just, you know, really bad with memory or other things like that. And since there's no attention given to the condition, it just progresses and progresses and progresses.
Wow. And this is really tied in very importantly, Dr. Karazian, to the gut, all of these things.
Well, in the brain book, I have a chapter called the brain-gut axis, and it's a bidirectional type of pathway. The gut can impact the brain, and the brain can have major impacts on the gut. So one of the most overlooked things that we know about is the brain-gut axis. And by the way, for the brain book, I have over 1,000 peer-reviewed references in the book.
And 600 pages.
Right, 600 yeah. pages. Which, you know, and the way the brain book is written is that each chapter has a list of symptoms, and for people, if the symptoms apply to them, then they can follow through and read the chapter. But with the brain-gut axis, one of the things that we know is when you look at the brain, when it's functioning, is sending out 90% of its output to the brainstem. And within the brainstem, we have this area called the vagus. And the vagus nerve is really what activates our gut to have motility, to get blood flow to our gut, to make digestive enzymes. And when the brain starts to degenerate and the brain starts to fail, there's lack of activation of the vagus. So there's many, many people that have chronic gastrointestinal problems, and it's really brain-based. Since their brain isn't healthy and it's not able to activate their vagus, they get constipation, they can't move their food. When they can't move their food, the food ferments, they get bacterial overgrowths, they can't make enzymes, they think they're enzyme deficient, but they're enzyme deficient forever, and they get opportunistic bacteria and yeast overgrowths, and they have these chronic GI problems, and they typically go and see everyone for gut-related treatments and digestive enzymes, and really what needs to happen is their brain needs to become active. When you examine these patients, usually you see that when you just listen to their abdomen, there's very little bowel sounds. When you have them say, when you look at the back of their throat, that little punching bag should raise. That's innervated by the vagus nerve, and it just doesn't work. And many times you'll see these people that have so-called chronic gastrointestinal problems, but they really have a brain-based mechanism. But since no one's really done anything to improve the efficiency of their brain, they continue to have these brain mechanisms causing their gut dysfunction.
Wow, that's amazing. Now, you could understand how it could go from the gut to the brain, but from the brain to the gut, as you just described, it is fascinating.
Right, and there's plenty of research on this, and we know a lot of this research has initially been done with traumatic brain injury. They know that when people get traumatic brain injury, that they, within the first 3 hours, they get what's called intestinal permeability, that they get constant constipation and motility issues. And many people that get brain injury, they have to get fed special diets because they can't digest well. So the brain-gut axis is very, very real. There's lots of research done on it, but it's completely overlooked in the healthcare model. And this is one of the reasons why I had this need to write this brain book, because there's so many critical areas that are completely overlooked in both conventional and alternative that have profound impacts on patients. So many patients may start to notice that, you know, as their brain becomes unhealthier and they can't think as well and focus well and concentrate as well, now they have chronic gastrointestinal problems. And then when they walk into the, let's say, the alternative medicine world, they just don't have people in alternative medicine really looking at things associated with brain. They're going to check for enzyme deficiencies, and they'll have them. And they're going to check for leaky gut-related issues and bacterial overgrowth, and these patients will have them. But the mechanism is because the brain isn't firing into their vagus can't cause active motility, and they can't release enzymes, get blood flow. So it's a very, very, very common.
That's disease. Amazing. So let's go over, with your knowledge and research, of what are some of the main key reasons why this brain can get dysfunctional to even cause the gut problems in the first place. So just the overall health of the brain. What are some of the reasons why it's happening so much in our culture?
Well, basically when you just look at the brain, and you have to start with the neuron being the cell of the brain. The neuron has certain needs, and from a basic level, neurons need glucose and neurons need oxygen. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a lot of people have chronic dysglycemia. They have chronic blood sugar issues. chronic low blood sugar, so they get shaky, lightheaded, and irritable throughout the day. They've been doing that for 30 years. That does have an impact on brain. Many people are pre-diabetic. They have insulin resistance. Those shifts in glucose and insulin surges and those things have an impact on brain. As far as oxygen goes, many people have poor circulation. Many people have cold hands, cold feet. And those are indications that the brain is not getting oxygen too. So just from the very basic needs of a neuron, just not having enough glucose, not having enough oxygen, those things tend to degenerate the brain. The brain is the most sensitive tissue to inflammation. So when a person becomes chronically inflamed, doesn't matter if it's joint inflammation or gut inflammation, whatever, just the standard American diet and all the different environmental things that cause us to be inflamed, they absolutely take a toll on the brain. The brain has a very weak antioxidant protection system, and as people get more inflamed and they get dysglycemia, there tends to be a major consequence there. We also know that there's certain dietary proteins which are devastating to brain, and that obviously being gluten as the one that's most published right now in the scientific literature.
And so all the different dietary nutritional things preclude the idea then that the neurons are just not going to do what they need to do. And then that's going to go down into the vagus and the brainstem, and then lots of other things can happen from there.
Well, yeah, so here's the average scenario. You get a person who's got chronically sick, they don't know what's going on, they don't have a disease yet, so they really don't have much to offer them in conventional medicine, so when they go in and get their workups, they really can't find anything wrong with them because, again, there's no pathology.
Yeah.
So out of desperation, they go into alternative medicine trying to do things to make them function better. But over a period of time, whether it was chronic blood sugar issues or poor circulation or just inflammation in general, the brain starts to become unhealthy. The brain starts to degenerate. As your brain starts to degenerate, it loses output to its area called the vagus. There's poor gastrointestinal function. As they get gastrointestinal function promoted, there's greater inflammation, and they get into this vicious cascade of all these things then just deteriorating their brain health. As their brain health deteriorates, the first thing that they'll start to notice is they lose endurance. They lose brain endurance. They can't read as long as they used to. They can't focus as long as they used to. And then this becomes this very ugly cascade, and at the whole time, they go and see healthcare practitioners, and there's very, very, very little effort done to even the possibility that their brain may be unhealthy. And even if they do recognize it, many healthcare practitioners just do very trivial, basic stuff. Let's give you some fish oils. Let's give you some basic things.
Mm-hmm.
And then those things are just really not enough to make a difference.
Wow. So can you give us some of the best foods for the brain and the worst foods for the brain?
Well, the worst foods for the brain were, it's not just necessarily foods themselves, but let's say the blood sugar response.
Mm-hmm.
So if a person is eating, like one of the things that we know is, let's say, a typical hypoglycemic. A hypoglycemic typically eats very, very well, meaning they eat healthy foods. They're not a junk food diet, but they constantly miss meals. They constantly get shaky, lightheaded, irritable. When they eat, they actually feel better. Those are all signs that they have hypoglycemia. Even though their food choices may not be bad, they're creating a state where the brain is deprived of glucose that accelerates neurodegeneration.
Oh.
Other terrible foods would be any kind of foods that cause insulin surges, foods that make people fall asleep after they eat. Those insulin surges have devastating effects. The insulin surges and the inflammation turn on what are called glial cells in the brain, and there's neurodegeneration. But as far as a specific food and protein, gluten tends to be one of them, and here's what we know about gluten. Researchers now are finding that the consequences of gluten are much more devastating on the brain than they ever were on the gastrointestinal tract. And there's papers out there that show that two-thirds of people that have gluten-causing brain degeneration do not have any intestinal complaints at all.
Wow.
So one of the things that we know is that many people have been looking in the wrong place for gluten intolerance. So if it's not gastrointestinal, they pretty much dismiss the symptoms altogether. So the interesting thing is also that gluten has been shown to be a major trigger for neurological autoimmunity. And one of the things that they found is that gluten can cause what they call cross-reactivity or molecular mimicry with two types of tissues in brain. One is called cerebellum tissue, and then there's a protein called synapsin, and then an enzyme called GAD. So what they're actually finding is that gluten is so close to the protein structure of brain, and when we say gluten, we mean this hybridized new gluten, new wheat protein, that the gluten we have today, that when they put it in different dishes and do these ELISA testing, they can actually see that the immune system recognizes gluten protein as if it was neurological tissue protein. So there's been some really fascinating research published, which I've referenced throughout the book, of where they're seeing that as certain people, certain individuals eat gluten, they're actually promoting neurological autoimmunity.
And they could have no gut issues, Dr. Krizian, and never know it.
No gut issues. All they do is they just eat their bread and the other things like everyone else. There's no digestive problems, but their brain starts to fade. They start to get brain fog. Their brain endurance goes down, and then, you know, they basically degenerate their brain.
My goodness. Is there foolproof test to see if you're gluten intolerant?
Well, you know, when you look at gluten intolerance, there's a whole chapter in the book about the importance of getting the proper test. And most people that get gluten testing today are getting, let's say, serine gliadin or even a transglutaminase test. And the interesting thing about gluten is that gluten has many different branches, that gluten has many different types of areas where their immune response could be. So the typical test for gluten sensitivity is what they call a gliadin test. But there's alpha gliadin, there's gamma gliadin, there's different types of glutenin proteins. There's deamidated gliadin.
Wow.
There's about 20 different gliadin proteins that really need to be checked. So
wow.
Unfortunately, what happens is many people that get screened for gluten sensitivity just don't get enough thorough testing. So in the book, I do talk about all the different strains of gliadin and how important it is to test each one of these strains. Like, for example, deamidated gliadin is basically processed gliadin. And some people don't test to actual gliadin until it's been deamidated. So these are people who are very sensitive to food that's been processed but may not react to on a blood test with gliadin that is just the actual wheat structure before they go through the food processing system.
My goodness. So Dr. Krizian, I guess the one that's the most well-known is this EnteroLab. Does that just do a few of these 20 things that you need to know?
So EnteroLab is a lab that does the digestive stool analysis, and they just basically do transglutaminase 2 and alpha gliadin. The test that I use with patients is a test from Cyrex Labs.
Cyrex Labs?
Yeah, C-Y-R-E-X, Cyrex Labs, and they have a webpage.
Mm-hmm.
But what they do is they break down the entire, what's known as the gluten proteome, and the entire gluten proteome includes multiple branches. And it's very clear that unless all those branches are tested, many people may not actually find their gluten sensitivity. But also what branches get shown as positive also give you some clues, do provide us some clinical clues. So, for example, one of the common tests that's done by most labs, including Intero and Cyrex, is transglutaminase. Transglutaminase is the enzyme that digests gluten, and it's the laboratory marker for celiac disease. But what researchers have found and published is that there's different types of transglutaminase. There's transglutaminase 2, which is intestinal. There's transglutaminase 3, which is skin. And there's transglutaminase 6, which is brain.
My goodness.
So EnteroLabs doesn't test the different versions of transglutaminase. And with Cyrex, I prefer it because it tests for all three. And transglutaminase 6 becomes very important because in the literature, that's the gluten marker that tends to be associated with gluten causing brain degeneration and not so much just gut intestinal symptoms.
Wow. So, God, if you ever were on a game show and you had to guess what percentage of people are gluten intolerant if they did the Cyrex test of 20 markers, what do you think, what would it be? What's your best guess?
Well, it's tough to say. I think I am a little bit biased in my own world as a healthcare practitioner.
Because you see a lot of it.
Yeah, but I would say that when I talked to Aristo Vijdani, who is the chief scientific developer at Cyrex, he's a world-renowned immunologist. They did their own in-house testing, which they're going to publish soon, but the testing of the random population. And what they found was a little bit over one-third of the U.S. population had gluten sensitivity markers. Now, I thought that was really maybe too low.
I thought it would be low as well.
Right, but that's just the random total population of different age groups and all different types. For people that have any related symptoms of digestive issues and brain issues, in my practice, it's up there at 90%. So,
It almost feels like with much as you've told us about gluten over the years, that it'd be better just to get off it, forget it, you know, and just stay away from it. It's a lot easier and cheaper and everything, wouldn't it be?
Absolutely, and here's the interesting thing. What we also know is being gluten-free is not enough. That what they found in different papers, and again, I have this in the chapter on the gluten, mm-hmm. gluten associated with brain, and we go into this a little bit deeper, is that they found that certain proteins can cross-react with gluten as well. So even though their person is gluten-free, they're eating other types of grains that are so close in structure that can still cause that perpetuating gluten immune response. And they found, for example, rice can be cross-reactive with gluten, and sesame can be cross-reactive with gluten. So one of the other things that I typically like to do is with Cyrex, they offer the test as well. It's what they call a cross-reactive grains food. So we like to see people that are that we know are gluten-sensitive. We want to see if they have any cross-reactivity. So we, for example, let's say someone has been gluten-free, but they just still don't feel better.
Right.
Many times we'll read this cross-reactivity, and they have several foods that they have cross-reactivity to. And then until they remove those foods, they don't really see their brain fog and their inflammation and those things go away, too.
My goodness. So you could be eating a cross-reactive food.
Right.
And like rice or corn or something, not know it, have inflammation in your body, and never really understand why.
That's right. And here's even a more common scenario. A person has gluten sensitivity, and
right.
they cross-react with brain tissue antibodies. Synapsin, for example, the protein in neurons, has been shown to be close enough to the structure of gluten. And cross-reactivity simply means when you look at the amino acid structure of a protein, there's three amino acids or more in identical sequence. And when there's three amino acids or more in identical sequence with protein, then there's the potential for the immune system to also make antibodies against that. So gluten and, let's say, synapsin have that three amino acid or more sequence, so they can cross-react with each other. So now you have a person eating gluten, and they're triggering immune responses against their own synapsin, which is found in all their neurons throughout their body. Now they're starting to get accelerated brain degeneration. But they also start to develop cross-reactivity with rice to gluten. So now they decide to go gluten-free, but they're eating all these rice-based products, and since they're eating rice, there's still that molecular mimicry, and that whole inflammatory gluten response has never stopped because it just wasn't aggressive enough.
Wow. Yeah. Is there a blood test or another test to test the amount of inflammation throughout the body?
Well, you know, there's different types of markers overall for mm-hmm. systemic inflammation. The most commonly general known ones are like C-reactive protein and ESR. But when you really look at the inflammatory cascade, you can go down as far as measuring markers for tumor necrosis factor, and you can look at inflammatory cascades like cytokines. There's a lot of options. It just becomes how much does the patient spend to look for these things.
Yeah.
And sometimes the inflammation is pretty obvious. You know, now as far as brain inflammation goes, the main symptom of brain inflammation is brain fog. And one of the things we know with inflammation in the brain is as the brain becomes inflamed, neurons lose what they call their conduction speed. Conduction speed is how fast neurons send the signal from one neuron to the other. So clinically, a lot of times we'll see when people have systemic inflammation, until that inflammation is reduced, that their brain fog won't go away. Now, it's interesting because when you look at brain inflammation can be a very ugly scenario. When you look at the brain has two types of cells, neurons and glial cells. And glial cells are more than half the mass of the brain. And when those get turned on from systemic inflammation, they many times stay on for long periods of time. And there's really no off switch for glial cells. So many times people may have certain types of systemic inflammations, and their brain starts to become inflamed, and their nerve conductions in their brain goes down. They start to get brain fog. And in the literature right now, when they look at some of the studies being done to identify mechanisms of depression, researchers are now going into a different model of depression, and it's called the cytokine model of depression or the inflammatory model of depression. It's not based on being just low in a neurotransmitter. Like in the past, the focus has really been on things like serotonin or dopamine or things like that. So researchers are finding is that inflammation itself can cause depression, and part of the reason is because as the brain becomes inflamed, the speed of the brain itself goes down, and when the speed of the brain goes down in the frontal cortex, people suffer from depression. So a lot of times people end up with fatigue issues and brain fog and depression, and they have this neuroinflammatory consequence in brain. Now, a lot of times reducing systemic inflammation may not be enough, and there's about a few hundred papers now in the literature that show there are different natural flavonoids that specifically dampen glial cells and neuroinflammation. And those are, like, for example, apigenin, which is a flavonoid from celery and parsley, and luteolin. from different types of vegetables. But when those things are concentrated as flavonoids in supplements, they can be very, very effective in dampening neuroinflammation.
Hmm. So I know that so much of your work is to teach people how to do these things without pharmaceutical medicines. And I have your book, and it's
right.
very easy to read, and you go through, and you have a lot of different things that people can take, natural supplements and natural things like to reduce brain inflammation. But are these things just symptomatic and using these natural medicines like medicine because they're just crutches and you have to get to the cause of the inflammation, or are they really getting to the problem of the inflammation? Probably a broad question, but...
Yeah. Well, you know, when you look at the differences, one of the things we know is, for example, if you look at the top 10 prescribed medications, they're usually basically antidepressants.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a short window of time where they work, or they may not work at all. And all they're really doing is try to make that neurotransmitter hang out in that space called the synaptic cleft a little bit longer, and they're all short-lived, and they've all been shown to have limited effects. And by the way, they're not even ethically approved for just depression. They're only been approved by the FDA for suicidal tendencies, but they hand them out like it's candy. And at the end of the day, no one asks the question why they have depression or need for certain antidepressants in the first place. When you look at the model of what we present in the book, we talk about mechanisms that are associated why the brain may not be healthy.
Mm-hmm.
For example, low blood sugar imbalance is a mechanism. Lack of circulation is a mechanism. Inflammatory cascades is a mechanism. Neurological autoimmunity is a mechanism. So it's important to not just say, hey, you have depression, just take this pill, but to identify which mechanisms of the brain are not healthy. So I think there's about 20 chapters in the book, and we talk about all the various mechanisms, but the way the book is organized is that in the opening, there's a list of questions related to each mechanism, and then lets the reader maybe not have to invest in reading the whole book, but they can invest in reading certain areas of the book that maybe are specific to them.
I see.
So, for example, if they have brain fog, like we talked about, and their body hurts and they ache and they have inflammation, then maybe the chapter related to neuroinflammation can be very important to them. And then we talk about strategies beyond just taking supplements, but diet, lifestyle, other things that may be triggers for that as well. So one of the things that's completely missing, and I believe both not only in conventional but in alternative, is we really still have this single symptom, either single drug or single symptom, single herb kind of model. And that's really an inefficient model, meaning you can't just go, you have depression, you take this one supplement, or, you know, you have insomnia, you just take this supplement. You have insomnia, just take some melatonin. That's really very limited, inefficient type of management. What's more efficient, what's more effective is when you identify mechanisms. So the way that I organize the book is it's all about these are all the major mechanisms that impact the brain. These are all the symptoms, and these are how we deal with all these mechanisms from a diet, nutrition, lifestyle approach.
Very interesting. Dattis Karazian, his new book is called Why Isn't My Brain Working? Follow-up to a landmark book he wrote on the thyroid 4 years ago, Why Do I Still Have Thyroid Symptoms? And if you have a question for him, patrick@oneradionetwork.com, and we'll continue after this from one of my favorite things, even though I'm not a girl. Daniel Vitalis, taking pine pollen raises testosterone levels. Why would that be a good thing for the girls?
We're beginning culturally to move past the idea of testosterone for boys, estrogen for girls, because it's a more complex issue than that. Men, of course, use progesterone, they use testosterone, they use estrogen. Women use testosterone as well as estrogen and progesterone. These things are in all of our bodies. And for all of us, what's happening is we're getting into a place of hyperinflated numbers of estrogens and very, very low numbers of androgens. So what will happen is you'll subtly increase the amount of androgens in your body. For men and women, this means increased metabolism, it means more lean body mass, it means higher energy levels. That's where the tincture, the organic alcohol tincture, is a better delivery system because it concentrates that material, it concentrates the androgens, and then it delivers it into the bloodstream. We're talking about the pine pollen gold or the pine pollen silver that we produce. That's the way to go.
Balancing hormones for men and women. Pine pollen from Sir Thrival. Click on the link and order on oneradionetwork.com. Previously with Brandon on organic Shizandra containing the five tastes.
Bitter, sour, sweet, pungent, and salty. It's similar to the emotions that we were talking about last hour, you know, how like worry or pensiveness affected the spleen, like you were mentioning. Every taste affects one of the five yin organ systems, or one of the five elements. In Chinese medicine, you can basically condense all energy in the universe down to five elements, which is fire, earth, metal, water, wood. Because everything's interconnected, everything can just be distilled down into these five elements. So all five flavors, as they enter into your body, start sending signals to your organ systems to basically create a response or an effect.
The vibration or the information in the Shizandra.
Right, and that's why it's really key to have an energetically vital product that has all those five flavors and all the tastes.
Yes, indeed. They go through great lengths to get this Shizandra to you in amazing quality. Click an order right on the front page, Organic Shizandra, OneRadioNetwork.com. I'm going to be asking Dr. Krazian about heavy metals and their effect, mercury and such, and all the different heavy metals that you might find out about, and the brain, and how to get those guys out. A good way to get them out of the body, I don't know if it'll work on the brain, maybe if you stick your head inside there, I don't know. Many people, especially in the Ayurvedic tradition, suggest when you do a sauna or a steam or a far infrared sauna that you do not get the head hot. The brain generally doesn't like to get hot. I'll ask Dr. Krazian. Well, the far infrared sauna that we have, you have your head outside of the unit. Unless, of course, you want to duck it in there and do the face, but I keep mine out, and generally... And these are nice, portable units that you will sweat. And I mean, you will sweat, and you will sweat, and you will sweat. I'm going to ask Dr. Krazian, I wonder if you can detox some of the heavy metals, which we know works, out of the skin, out of the body. Actually, they'll drain from the brain. That's a good question, right? See, they just keep coming. These are cool machines. We like them. $935 with the promo code ONERADIO. They're portable. And this unit, designed in Taiwan over, well, probably 10 years or so with China, it's a medical device. It's very, very different from a lot of the far-infrared saunas. The technology, the way it works, the modality, the unit, the healing light. It's a good one. It's very interesting. I think you'll find it even preferable. Well, I do. Well, I can't even say that because I've never had one of those wooden guys that you sit in it. But I like this one, and it's easy to use. And very, very gentle on the body, depending on how long you stay in and how many of the burners you put on there, the units you do. You can just go halfway if you want. You use the promo code ONERADIO, order through OneRadioNetwork.com, the Relax Far Infrared Sauna.
Know the source.
The source.
OneRadioNetwork.com. Talk to Patrick now. 888-663-6386. Or email patrick@oneradionetwork.com.
Dr. Daktis Krazian, he's a chiropractor and also has got a lot of other letters behind his name. Means a lot of stuff. The brainhealthbook.com is where you might want to go when you learn more about this new book just out. Brainhealthbook.com. I recommend it to you. It's 600 pages. They were nice enough to send me a copy, but It's not overwhelming and doesn't make your head explode reading it. I mean, it's easy to read, and they've got it really well organized, so you can just kind of find areas that you're keenly interested. The name of the book is Why Isn't My Brain Working? I guess you can get it on Amazon.com. If you do that, please go through our website, One Radio Network. We get a couple bucks, or not that, but a couple pennies. Dr. Krazian, what about this? You know, so much we know with the metals, heavy metals, mercury in the teeth, and mercury in the air and all the different heavy metals we can get.
Yeah.
These guys, I guess, get in the brain, don't they, or do they?
Okay, well, here's the very key things that are important about this. There are some very, very outdated concepts with heavy metals and neurological disease in the brain, all right? Let's start with one of the first major concepts. One of the first major concepts that we need to understand is there's a difference between quantity of heavy metals and immune reactivity to heavy metals, meaning that the most common ways people test for heavy metals today is that they go ahead and do what's a heavy metal screen. So they check for levels of lead or mercury or arsenic. through different tests, whether mm-hmm. it's a urine test or it's what they call a challenge test, where they have a person take DMSA and then they check their urine levels to see if they start to become elevated. But the problem with that is still a quantitative model.
Quantitative.
So how much is it? And the more metals you have, the worse it is theoretically.
Right.
That's somewhat outdated. And what we know about is that we all have some degree of heavy metals. Okay, that there's none of us that if we did a test that we would have zero. It's virtually rare to see
sure.
that. But there's a difference between whether you react to the heavy metal or not.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the ways to evaluate that is by chemical, heavy metal, or environmental antibodies. So there's a big difference between having mercury in your body, which we all do, versus having mercury antibodies. Mercury antibody means your immune system is attacking mercury.
Oh.
Now, in we talk about this in the chapter on toxins in the brain. So the concept of immunology that we know about is referred to as what's called chemical tolerance. So each one of us has a degree of what's called chemical tolerance. So we all have environmental compounds in our body, meaning we all have a little bit of pesticides, and we all have a little bit of mercury, we all have a little bit of everything, but we don't all react to them. But there are certain things that make us lose our tolerance, and then we start to react to them. Now, the ugly scenario you see clinically is someone, for example, may have mercury antibodies or heavy metal antibodies, and they also have myelin basic protein antibodies. So they're showing antibodies to their own nervous system, and they're showing antibodies to the environmental compounds. Okay,
mm-hmm.
And in those types of cases, the focus really needs to be on improving immune chemical tolerance. We know that classic chelators that are used, like DMSA, DMPS, and EDTA, research has shown, even though they may clear it out of the body, every single one of those redistributes heavy metals into the brain. And in the book, I reference the studies that have been published on that. So it's not the controversial. I mean, it's true. It's fact.
So the studies show that EDTA, what are the other ones?
EDTA, DMPS, DMSA, those are the classic chelating
sure.
agents people use.
Uh-huh.
They all three of them, have been published and shown in the scientific literature to redistribute heavy metals into brain.
Oh, great.
Into spinal cord.
Oh, that's wonderful.
So,
and that's still being used very, very widely in this culture, isn't it, Dr. Grazian?
Right, and you know, one of the things we have is we have people. Again, there's a lot of There's a lot of naive understanding of brain, and people just don't read up on the literature, and a lot of folklore stuff in the world of alternative medicine keeps getting regurgitated
sure.
back and back again, and no one really questions any of it.
Mm-hmm.
So, one of the things that is really, really clear is. There's a lot of people that just blame everything neurological and heavy metals. I mean, if it's, you know, and there are practitioners out there, and this is pretty standard. If you have tremor or you have anything, hey, it's got to be heavy metals. And then they check the level, but the level's high with everybody. So they make this huge jump that that's the cause of it. And it's not to say that it isn't, an issue of their health, but it may not be the driving cause. Now, here's the big difference. If someone has mercury antibodies, and now they have this loss of chemical tolerance, not only will things like DMSA, EDTA, and DMPS, the known chelators, redistribute it into their brain tissue, but as they pull them from their tissue and expose them to their immune cells, they're going to get an inflammatory consequence. So one of the things we talk about in the brain book is the environmental concerns with brain. There's multiple ones, but when it gets to heavy metals, you have to understand that there's this thing called chemical tolerance, and we let people look for symptoms associated with chemical tolerance loss. And if they have them, then that could be a major issue. You can't check for mercury antibodies and different types of heavy metal antibodies, which is different than checking the quantity. So when a person has those types of issues, the focus is really to try to improve their what's called immune chemical tolerance. The symptoms that someone has lost their chemical tolerance is they can't handle things like gasoline fumes or perfumes, or they can't handle detergents, or they can't handle certain lotions and shampoos anymore that they used to. And when that starts to happen, we're a little bit concerned for them. And whenever we see people that have those symptoms and they start to have neurodegenerative diseases, the quantity of the heavy metal isn't nearly as important to us as if they're having what's called loss of chemical tolerance.
Mm-hmm. And these antibodies, like mercury antibody or something, another arsenic or whatever, lead antibody, where do they come from?
So the lab that we use for that is the Cyrix Labs as well. Cyrix is the lab I use a lot of because they're the premier of world's best autoimmune lab. And one of the panels they have is environmental trigger panel. And the environmental trigger panel is there to look for environmentally induced types of tests. So what they actually do in their test is they're measuring, for example, mercury bound to human protein, and they're seeing if there's antibodies against it. That's the known mechanism of environmental-induced autoimmunity, that an environmental compound can actually bind to your own protein, and then at that point it becomes a completely new antigen, and then you may react to it. So in their chemical panel, it's also very interesting. We see many, many things that people react to, and one of the things people react to is bisphenol A, like plastics. And you'll see someone, for example, clinically, where they have some declining brain function, and they're progressively getting worse and worse, and then they'll have, for example, neurological tissue antibodies, like neurofilament antibodies or alpha-beta tubulin antibodies, and at the same time, they have bisphenol A antibodies, where they're actually reacting to plastic compounds, and then they're drinking, like, water bottles every day, and they're drinking, like, you know, Starbucks, and their lid is bisphenol A, and the hot tea or coffee activates the release of it, or they're microwaving their food in plastic, and they're getting this huge exposure of a compound that is now immune-activating. But in the case where we saw the neurological antibodies, it's going to pretty much deteriorate their brain. So every sip through a plastic bottle of water or foods that are contained in plastics is turning on their neuroautoimmunity. It's very, very sad.
Is it possible then that maybe all the different chemicals or mercury or thimerosal in the vaccines and the connection with autism, perhaps, I'm just brainstorming here, perhaps some of the kids have these antibodies and some of them don't?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know what the literature is really showing is very interesting is that they're finding that autism is able to be identified during the third trimester by measuring fetal brain antibodies. And the whole model of autism is, you know, controversial. There's people who believe that it's vaccine-based, people that believe that that it's not vaccine-based.
Sure.
But one of the things that is very interesting is there's now over a dozen papers with different universities in different parts of the world, so it's not just one researcher. But what they're finding is that there's a high degree of fetal brain antibodies, that within the development of the fetus, there's already a neurological attack against the immune system.
Wow. Okay, go ahead.
And the point with that is they're also finding that in the U.S., that when they check fetal tissue, there's over 300 different harmful chemicals in their body. And many of these bodies are autoimmune-promoting, cancer-promoting, neurodegenerative. So if you look at what's being done with, like, for example, autism, is that there's this very strong correlation with environment, meaning that even studies published in the Journal of American Medical Association and other prestigious and critical journals, what they have found was that if you live next to a freeway, your risk for autism dramatically goes up. So there's this neuro-environmental model that is probably there with autism. Now, if you get this child who has, let's say, fetal brain antibodies and their brain is being attacked by their immune system from day one when they're born, some of these kids may really fall apart with vaccination, even though the vaccine didn't cause it. But the vaccine is going to stimulate an autoimmunity.
Yes.
You can have devastation, and you can really see why parents really observe that.
Oh, the vaccines and then the problem. I see.
Right.
They make the connection, yeah. Wow. This Cyrex Labs you talk about, this environmental antibody test, is this a blood test?
Yeah, it's a blood test. It's a the chemical immune reactivity. They call it the array number 11. And basically what it checks for is heavy metal antibodies, mercury antibodies, but it also goes in and checks for things like plastic antibodies and fire retardant antibodies and many different chemicals that we're exposed to. Like, for example, all furniture in California has to be sprayed by fire retardants now.
Yes.
So formaldehyde antibodies, all your cushions and foamies type products are based in formaldehyde, and benzene antibodies like cigarette smoke or car exhaust. So they go through and just kind of evaluate if there's any loss of immune chemical tolerance, because for the most of us, we shouldn't react to some of these things. We shouldn't react to benzenes or formaldehyde, or we shouldn't have an overzealous reaction. And if we do, that means we've lost our chemical tolerance. So what the test really does is check to evaluate if a person still has their immune chemical tolerance intact. It's not a quantity test. It's not about how much you have. It's about, are you actually reacting to what you have? You could have trace levels of, let's say, mercury or trace exposures to fire retardants, but since your immune system goes crazy when it gets exposed to it, that's the concept of chemical tolerance and why they do that panel.
Are you saying, though, that you could have a heavy load of mercury, and if you don't have the antibodies, it doesn't affect the body?
No, that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying is that if you have high amounts of mercury,
mm-hmm.
your tolerance will determine how devastating it can
okay.
be for you.
Okay, your tolerance meaning how many antibodies you have, doctor.
Right, how you react to it. So,
how you react
for example,
to it.
I mean, there are people that have really high amounts of environmental compounds and they don't have any health problems, and some that do. Obviously, it is a, you know, anytime we see hazardous waste or toxins in our body, it's not always the best scenario. So we can't say that it's perfectly healthy and there's no problem with it. But we want to evaluate more than just the quantity, because sometimes you don't have high amounts, but you have severe reactions to them.
Mm-hmm. So living in the world that we live in and knowing what you said about the EDTA and the common kind of chelation thing, which you said that the research shows is dangerous, would it make sense then to do everything we can to detoxify from any kind of metals or toxic material with sweating or, I don't know, different foods or who knows, just anyway, if we could get it out of the body? That makes sense, doesn't it?
Well, here's what we have to also really consider. Not every environmental compound can be detoxified, okay? Meaning that when we say detoxification, that's what's known as hepatic biotransformation. Hepatic biotransformation is how our liver takes a substance that's...
and sends it out.
...that's soluble and then makes it water-soluble to clear it.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have hepatic biotransformations for mercury or lead, okay? You can't get it out through your liver pathways. It's just not going to happen, okay?
How does it come out?
So there's different things that you can do to come out, but one of the, but we know, and then let me continue with that.
Okay.
We also know that we can't use some of the known chelators like DMPS and EDTA, because even though they can pull it out, they redistribute into brain, which is really an ugly scenario, especially if someone has neurodegenerative issues.
Right.
The other issue is, I know you mentioned saunas that may have some benefits for lots of chemicals, such as BPA or formaldehyde and fire retardants and isocyanates and benzenes. Those can be promoted with sauna. But some of these stronger types of heavy metals, one of the most promising things is probably just to use glutathione.
Glutathione, yeah.
Glutathione doesn't redistribute metals into the brain, and it does help support. With very acute, severe cases, you may have to use IV glutathione. With less severe cases, you can use natural things to release glutathione. And if the goal is to try to get rid of the actual level, the actual quantity, then what's usually done is people do a urinary heavy metal test, and as they're doing their therapy, they retest that and see if the levels are getting higher. If the levels are getting higher, that means it's working.
And
it can be done with anything.
And we can get some of these things out through the gut, can't we?
Well, again, if it goes out through the gut, it has to become water-soluble. So the liver has to go through this hepatic biotransformation and take a compound to make it water-soluble. Once it becomes water-soluble, we can eliminate it through our feces, urine, and sweat. You know.
But the liver can't do it to mercury or lead.
No, the liver cannot metabolize and clear out mercury and lead through its own pathways.
Is that the only two?
Well, every heavy metal, for the most part, the liver itself does not have enzymes to clear. And the compounds that the liver can't clear are typically considered, to us as human beings, poisons and hazardous waste.
Wow. My goodness. So, okay, let's take a few questions, okay? What's going on when I wake up in the morning and I feel groggy, neck strain? Is this a type of brain inflammation? I've read once before that has to do with brain waves being low upon waking up from Stephen and somewhere.
Well, you know, anytime a person wakes up and they already have impaired brain function, there's something going on with the brain. Whether it's wavelengths or other things, it's really hard to say. But, you know, all those things are possible. But the point being is you should wake up refreshed. You should wake up with your brain ready to go. So when a person wakes up groggy or can't function and their neck is really, really tight, and neck tightness is really a consequence of brain too many times, because it's the brain that fires into those pools of neurons that control muscle tone. I mean, obviously, there could be that they slept improperly and strained their neck. But if it's not those things, then we know that the overall health of the brain is impaired. Now, it's too hard to say just from those general symptoms what the mechanism is. But at least it's a sign that the brain's unhealthy. So when your brain's healthy, you should wake up and have your clearer function and be able to think and focus and concentrate. Many people that have unhealthy brains, when they wake up, they don't feel like they've rested well, they haven't slept well, they can't think, they can't focus. Some of them need to get a stimulant to make their brain work again, most common one being caffeine, so they can function again. But those are things that are important.
Is caffeine okay for the brain?
Well, you know, it's really interesting because it depends on if you just look at the evidence or if you look at clinical function in patients. If you actually look at just what's been published, caffeine is phenomenal for brain. Caffeine increases circulation and blood flow and decreases Alzheimer's and amyloid plaques and has fascinating events that the flavonoids in coffee themselves protect the brain, and as you increase circulation and blood flow of the brain, it seems to make a difference. But then that's all just in the scientific world and not necessarily in the clinical world. In the clinical world, you'll see some people who coffee just devastates them, and they really can't function until they go off it, because at the end of the day, it is a stimulant. At the end of the day, it does have impacts on what are called catecholamine receptors, and sometimes catecholamine receptors aren't healthy. So there's a difference between what's published and what many clinicians observe. So it's really unique to where you're looking.
Okay. Overall, are there tests that people can take that really gives them some good markers of the brain health?
Well, I think when you look at brain health, there is no general test that says your brain is healthy or not.
Hmm.
Most of the stuff related to brain health is related to how do you function?
How do you
remember? How do you focus? How do you concentrate?
Mm-hmm.
And how long does it take for you to get tired?
Mm-hmm.
So as the brain becomes unhealthy, first thing that really goes is endurance. And people just can't do things as long as they used to that requires brain-concentrated efforts. Whether it's driving, they can't drive too long without getting tired and having them pull over, whether it's reading. So there's no really lab test for that. A lot of times it's just about how you notice your brain function performs. Now, a lot of people blame everything that's related to neurodegeneration on aging. Well, you can't focus, you can't remember, you can't think, you're just getting older. That's not true. Those symptoms are because your brain is degenerating. It's becoming unhealthier.
Oh, that's not good. What about, well, let me take this email because this is interesting. Leon, he is in, not sure where he is. I've been struggling with hypoglycemia most of my life. Are there some foods that I can eat that will help it not affect my brain as much as you say it does? Thanks for the show.
Well, obviously, when someone has hypoglycemia, the most important thing to do is just to it's not the type of foods you necessarily eat. However, foods that are higher in protein and fiber tend to make it easier to stabilize blood sugar levels. It's the frequency of how a person eats. And there are mechanisms that do make a person chronically hypoglycemic. There's endocrine mechanisms, like someone who's got chronic adrenal insufficiency, they just don't have enough cortisol to get their blood sugar level stable. There's some people that have adrenal glands that no one is able to fix because they have antibodies to their adrenal glands, and they're actually having autoimmunity against their adrenal glands, and that's called Addison's disease. But with Addison's disease, you don't really test for it outside the laboratory levels until 90% of the adrenal glands are destroyed. So there are people who have chronic hypoglycemia and they can't really fix their adrenal glands because their immune system's attacking their adrenals and they may not be at 90% loss, so it gets identified conventionally. They may have only lost 50% of their adrenal function. There's also neurological mechanisms that chronically make people hypoglycemic. And basically, there's an area in the brain called the midbrain, and the midbrain has an area called the tectum. And many times when this area is firing way too much, people get sound and light sensitivity and trivial types of movements like flashes of light or things really, really, really bother them. And the area of the brain, the midbrain where the tectum is, fires directly to autonomic centers that may have an impact on releasing epinephrine, and they burn up their glucose, and some of these people really can't get their blood sugar under control until they fix their brain. So there is sometimes a vicious cycle, and it's not just like eat more frequently. There's times where you have to investigate the mechanism. But for the most part, even despite what the mechanism is, if a person has hypoglycemia, the single most important thing to do is eat as frequently as possible to avoid those symptoms. And some people have to eat every hour when they get really chronic until the mechanism could be identified.
until you can figure out what is the main cause.
The biggest mistake is a lot of people assume that their hypoglycemia is okay because they eat healthy, but mm-hmm. what they assume as being healthy is like they're eating fruit all day, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And that's still not enough protein and fiber to really stabilize them.
At the beginning of the show, when you alluded to the idea that the brain, and then you go down the upper cervical, the vagus, and that is causing some issues. I'm wondering, as a chiropractor, how keen are you then with your folks maybe doing some upper cervical work themselves and making sure that that pathway is happy?
Well, here's the thing. Anything that's done to the body from alternative medicine, for the most part, is brain-based. If you smell something, you're like aromatherapy, you're stimulating your olfactory receptors. If you get an adjustment, you're stimulating mechanoreceptors and proprioceptors. If you're getting massage, you're stimulating muscle spindles. If you're doing light therapy, you're firing visual occipital type pathways. So at the end of the day, when you look at what people get done to them, it's basically a sensory-based therapy. They're smelling something, someone's rubbing them, someone's stretching them, someone's adjusting their joints, someone's making them look at different colors. You know, all the things that take place in alternative medicine, ultimately are all brain-based therapies because they're firing receptors. Those receptors have a consequence in a change in brain. So, yes, I mean, any kind of...
So they're all good.
You know, well, they're not all good because sometimes they're not all effective. So
I see.
But it's unique to the individual and not unique to everybody. So let's say, for example, someone had depression and couldn't focus and couldn't concentrate, and their olfactory, their smell pathways just were not firing well for whatever reason. They go and see someone that does aromatherapy, and that aromatherapy increases the firing of that pathway. Their brain lights up. Now their depression has changed. Now their brain is functioning at a higher level. And now they swear by aromatherapy. This is it. I need to do aromatherapy. This is fantastic.
Right.
They get all their friends to do aromatherapy, but the friends that go for aromatherapy don't have their olfactory pathway impaired. So
gotcha.
There's no impact for them. So then they go, I just wasted my money with this aromatherapy person. Another person swears by it. And the same thing is true for manipulation of the spine or other things that maybe a chiropractor can do.
Mm-hmm.
Some people may not have the same outcome because of their brain health altogether and pathways that are related to it. So upper cervical, we know, has very profound impacts in for firing mechanoreceptors because of the mechanoreceptor load. And here's the other thing. Some people that have brain degeneration, they can't handle that type of stimulus. And when people's brain starts to degenerate and fail, they may not handle the environment that they're living in itself, loud music or sound or manipulation. And so there's some people that really, really fall apart when they get activation. There's people who have brain degeneration. If they get a massage, they get nauseous and sick, and they hate it. You know. So what we have to really realize is whether someone does aromatherapy or visual therapies or manipulation or do things like yoga, that at the end of the day, those types of things are evoking receptors, mechanoreceptors, proprioceptors, visual receptors, olfactory receptors. Those receptors then terminate in an area of the brain and fire, but the brain has to have the endurance and the health to be able to respond to that stimulus.
Jason asks, is coconut oil as good as they say for the brain?
Well, like everything else, again, there's coconut oil has benefits for brain, but basically so does every single blueberry, flavor fruit, mm-hmm, or anything that's fiber. It's not that simple. I mean, the goal for us is really to go into what are mechanisms that are involved. And usually looking at just the food that's healthy for the brain isn't looking at a mechanism. So, you know, we all see chronic patients that go from one person to the next. They're eating everything. They're taking handfuls and handfuls of vitamins and supplements. And unfortunately, they never get their mechanism itself assessed. And that's the key point with the book. I have a high level of frustration with conventional and alternative medicine, simplifying everything and not looking at mechanisms based on physiology. So, I mean, you just don't want to go, hey, you have a bad brain, eat coconut.
Sure. Is low-fat diet detrimental to the brain?
Well, low-fat diet has major impacts to the brain. And we need to have some healthy fat in our body, and we need to have cholesterol in our body for healthy brain function too. So we do need to make sure we have healthy levels of fat, and we're talking about good fats here. We're not talking about just saturated inflammatory fats. Things that raise acridonic acid, like excess consumption of processed or red meats, they're not the best thing for the brain. But fats found in fish and nuts and seeds are critical for brain health. And also critical for a neurotransmitter called acetylcholine. So acetylcholine is this neurotransmitter that is what's called the memory neurotransmitter. It's the neurotransmitter that allows you to maintain your focus, your concentration, your visual recall. And acetylcholine has to have choline to function, and dietary choline has a huge impact on this. So sometimes when people go on a fat-free diet or a limited-fat diet, they're really decreasing their choline exposure, and they're inefficient in making choline. The brain can still make acetylcholine because it could break down its own phospholipids and provide it, so they're still function, but the function is not ideal. So we'll see typically people that go on low-fat, fat-free diets initially present with low acetylcholine symptoms, poor memory, poor focus for concentration, and things like that.
So you would tend towards a fish, and you any risk of mercury there over, say, a grass-fed beef, you say, is better for the brain?
Well, again, it depends on each individual. Obviously, right. Mercury is never something we like to have to brain. But what we also have to understand is that just because we consume it doesn't mean it gets in the brain. And one of the things we also have to evaluate is that there is the blood-brain barrier. And there's reasons why people have a blood-brain barrier failure. So if someone's blood-brain barrier is breached, dietary exposure to fish oil or fish supplements high in mercury could be more devastating.
Mm-hmm.
If someone has lost their chemical tolerance and they get mercury exposure, that could be devastating to brain as well, right?
Yeah.
So if someone has intact blood-brain barriers and has chemical tolerance and they don't react to mercury from an immunological perspective, they may not have the same consequence. But for the most part, you know, we don't want mercury or hazardous compounds in the body for health altogether. We want to support the things.
Well, Doc, you can certainly see what a conundrum most of our listeners are in, because it's a tricky game, and there's not a whole lot of people that really look at things in a very, very careful manner these days, even the natural docs, right? As you know.
Absolutely.
It's just, wow. So we have to almost play our own doctor. We have to get books like yours, I think, and learn more about this so we can do a lot of the research and find the right people to help us.
Well, that's the whole purpose of writing this brain book. Because one of the first questions you asked me is, why did you write it? Well, yeah. I wrote this topic versus other topics because this is an area of major need. There's so many people that are suffering from brain consequences, and we know that just the aging population, there's no hope for them for this because no one's doing anything for them. We know that 1 out of 8 children today has a developmental disorder, whether it's ADD or autism or dyslexia.
Wow.
So we have a growing population of poor brain health. It's getting worse and worse, and we don't have people in alternative or conventional addressing any parts of this, but the research world itself is filled with information. And there's this gap between taking that information and exposing it to practitioners and to the public. So The goal of the book was to do that.
Amico in Colorado writes, can you explain epilepsy in the brain?
Well, epilepsy is what they call epileptiform activity. It's spontaneous frequency of firing. It's spontaneous firing of neurons. And we know that there's multiple mechanisms for epilepsy. Trauma-induced could be one of them. Chemical alterations can be another one of them. And sometimes they just don't know. When they send a person out to EEG, they have epilepsy and seizure activity, but they don't know where it's coming from. But at the end of the day, if you can make the brain healthier, then you may have a mechanism where spontaneous firing in the brain may not take place as much. But each case is so specific, and with epilepsy, you can't just play around with it and just say take the supplement, because you can get a person that can really have some compromise. And sometimes epileptic activity, if you just don't take it serious enough and you don't be careful with it, each event gets to be more serious and more serious and more serious, and then it can become really an ugly scenario. So At the end of the day, you can do strategies just to improve brain health and see if it changes epileptiform activity or neurons firing spontaneously on their own. But it's hard to say just from a phone call what the
therapy would be. Yeah. Paul writes that he wants to prevent strokes. There are some strokes in his family,
right,
and his heredity, and the things he should do, take, or eat to help prevent him getting a stroke someday.
Okay, well, stroke is very, very, very real. And there's two types of stroke. There's the conventional main types of stroke, which everyone's familiar with. That's when you have an event, and then all of a sudden you can't speak, and you get slurred words, and you have people with their posture. And then there's another type of stroke, what they call silent stroke. Okay? Silent stroke means you have a little tiny blood vessel rupture in part of your brain, and you lose some types of function, but you don't have the obvious, like, posture change. You don't lose your ability to speak. Like, for example, a very common cause of restless leg syndrome is what they call a silent stroke. That this little small branch that goes into an area called the basal ganglia infarcts, and then the person all of a sudden has this restless leg-based syndrome. So many people are suffering from silent stroke all day, and this becomes what's called microvascular disease, and it starts with one area and then goes to other areas of the brain, and vascular dementia is the second most common cause of dementia, only to Alzheimer's.
Uh-huh.
So when we say that we look at stroke, we have to really define it, you know, that there's also silent stroke, okay? Now, as far as stroke goes, either silent stroke or conventional, typical strokes that we're all familiar with, there's no question in the world hypertension is a factor. It's not controversial. You know, like cholesterol is controversial with people.
Sure.
People argue different points. There's no way you can argue that hypertension is not a risk for stroke.
Okay.
So ultimately, the very first thing to do is check your blood pressure and make sure your blood pressure is not too high. And if your blood pressure is high, you have to get that down to reduce your risk for stroke.
Mm-hmm.
Now, other than that, blood vessel health itself is really, really critical to prevent stroke activity. So in the brain book, I have a whole chapter on circulation and blood flow to brain, and many things that have been shown to be helpful. For example, vinpocetine. Vinpocetine is an herb that has been shown to increase blood flow and circulation to the brain. So even if you don't have a stroke, it can help you get healthier circulation to the brain, not through increasing blood pressure, but through causing a release of something called endothelial nitric oxide synthase, which dilates arteries. So that actually may even have an effect to lower blood pressure. And vinpocetine also protects blood vessels. The flavonoids in the plant actually protect blood vessels and keep them from inflammatory states, which is one of the mechanisms how blood vessels weaken. And then they also have used in several studies vinpocetine post-stroke. So when people get a stroke, they give them vinpocetine, and since it increases blood flow circulation, improves blood vessel health, many people recover much, much faster, and their quality of life dramatically improves compared to controls when they actually take vinpocetine.
And are those both herbs?
Yeah, vinpocetine, V-I-N-P-O-C-E-T-I-N-E.
Never heard of those ones. Well,
yeah.
They're pretty eclectic herbs.
There's a list of herbs that really impact brain, but they're not common in mainstream.
Yeah, I've never heard of those.
We talk about a lot of those in the
book. So you got a whole book on that.
Each chapter has specific things, but like luteolin, apigenin, vinpocetine, these are things that are not commonly known, but they're great research with them.
Huh. And is there a lot of this silent stroke thing going on? Is this pretty prevalent?
Yeah. I mean, there's probably listeners right now that have silent strokes every single day that we know about it because it's silent.
And they
show up on brain imaging, but what they notice is as they lose one blood vessel versus another and versus another, they start to have declines in brain function.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes it becomes a little more obvious because they may get a little bit of slurred speech for a few days. Their balance may be off for a few days, and then it starts to come back, and sometimes it doesn't come back, but it depends on how far they are. The reason they call them silent strokes is because you just don't know they're happening many times.
And what causes these things?
Well, it goes back to blood vessel health.
Blood vessel health, yeah. And that's all through diet?
Well, obviously, when we look at blood vessel health, there's no question in the world that diet has a major, major impact on it. Blood pressure through diet, people who have high blood pressure because their diet's very high in sodium and other types of things that raise it, and mm-hmm. stimulants may have issues with it. The blood pressure, so here's how this works. The blood vessel itself has what's called the vascular endothelium. The vascular endothelium releases something called nitric oxide, which helps protect the arteries. As blood pressure gets high, it starts to eat away at the vascular endothelium, just like waves eating away at the sand on the beach. And as that area, the blood vessels start to get lost forever, then that blood vessel can't keep itself healthy. And then what it contributes to that is just systemic inflammation. The more inflammation a person has, the more compromised blood vessels suffer. And most of the research in conventional medicine have been done with things like high homocysteine, an inflammatory compound that destroys blood vessel health. But we know that any kind of inflammation can destroy blood vessel health. So the more compromised someone's blood vessel health is, the higher their blood pressure are, the more risk they are for silent infarcts and strokes. And we also know methylation, this path with homocysteine, where B vitamins become very useful. Different types of methyl donors like B12 folic acid can be helpful. So there's no doubt that dietary things have a profound impact on stroke, meaning it's not just a genetic type of thing. You have the genes and you get a stroke. It's not that. It's how you change your blood vessel expression. So higher blood pressure, more inflammation, lack of health, just basic nutrients, can absolutely increase risk factors for sudden strokes and major strokes.
The factors with fat, cholesterol, or calcium that are always generally talked about, the heart for being a problem, are those two factors also in the brain?
Well, the health of the brain is blood vessel health without question.
So it's all throughout the body?
It's all throughout the body.
So if one would have high calcium levels around the heart or too much fatty deposits around the heart for whatever reason, they're probably having that in the brain as well?
Yeah, I mean, the calcification probably takes place everywhere. So one of the things that I do is I teach brain dissection at Vassar University, California.
Wow.
And when we take out these brains and extract them, we never jump into just cutting them up, and we just really appreciate the brain. And one of the things we'll do is we'll just feel the blood vessels. And a lot of times what you'll see with people, you'll see certain people that have that their blood vessels themselves, their brain themselves are atrophied. So like when you pull out a brain out of a human body for dissection, when you put your hands on it, you have these little gyri and sulci. And these gyri and sulci should be very, very tight. But if you can put your hand on the brain and they sink in, then that's basically brain atrophy. And on brainbookhealth.com, I show some video clips of normal brains and unhealthy brains, and you can see the difference in gyri and sulci. But a lot of times when you see this brain degeneration, you just go to the blood vessel that supplies that part of the brain, and you just palpate it with your fingers, and a lot of times you just hear that crunching, crunch type of sound. It's calcification.
Wow.
So a lot of times as people calcify and develop poor blood vessel health, the areas of the brain that those vessels supplied are compromised, and then those tissues degenerate because the blood is carrying all the glucose and oxygen and nutrients and hormones and all the things the brain needs to function. So when the brain doesn't get what it needs, the fuel source, the essential nutrients needs, it starts to atrophy away. So there's no question in the world that blood vessel disease is systemic, and people that have calcifications and different types of blood vessel compromise throughout any part of their carotid arteries or heart also have it in their brain.
Wow. And the calcium is different from the cholesterol, correct?
Well, you know, at the end, there's overlap between these mechanisms, but basically calcium and cholesterol is just basically trying to patch up the inflammatory
disease. Sure, they're just trying to patch it up.
Right.
But if you would test for calcium and you don't have that, you could still have cholesterol?
Yeah, and at the end of the day, I don't know if it's the single nutrient, but yeah, when they look at the different blood vessels, atherosclerosis type of thing, there's a mixture of different substances.
They're all in there trying to repair the thing, but they're not necessarily separate.
Yeah, at the end of the day, you know, something's blocking this up, but the bigger issue is what's causing a need to block this destruction, to patch up this destruction, right?
But do you think that it's been inflammation and infection or something like that that caused the cholesterol to try to do this, like many people are saying?
Do you
think that's true?
It's definitely inflammation, and it's also very interesting is there's the antigen model of heart disease where certain types of infections can destroy blood vessels.
Right.
There's about 10,000 papers published now, if you just go to the PubMed, National Library of Science, where they found H. pylori, the bacteria that causes gastric ulcers, directly destroys blood vessel health. So just like, for example, hepatitis can destroy the liver, H. pylori that causes gastric ulcers also destroys vascular endothelium cells. So a lot of times when they look at these plaques, whether it's cholesterol or calcium-based, they see pathology reports, see H. pylori-induced mechanisms. So,
And of course, Doc, as you know, years ago, with Framingham, they found cholesterol there, so that was deemed the culprit, right, or the perpetrator of the crime.
Right. I mean, there's been the plumber model of cholesterol is really a joke, you know. I just think there's no evidence for it if it keeps being perpetuated. But at the end of the day, you have so many people that are inflamed, and the bottom line is the inflammatory cascade. But, I mean, if you do look at the way they have organized research papers and what's been published, it's very easy to convince a naive healthcare practitioner that's the model that needs to be focused on.
Sure.
And that does take place in standard medicine.
So what are your top anti-inflammatory natural things to just work? What are your top ones?
Well, I mean, let's start with, let's just say in relation to brain.
Okay.
Okay? Since this is the topic. In relation to brain, the number one anti-inflammatory thing that a person can do is, first of all, avoid gluten.
Okay.
Okay.
Gotcha.
I mean, it's just so many people that have poor brain health end up with gluten issues, so we want to be anti-inflammatory by avoiding, not just by adding food.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to kind of answer your question, not from foods, but from a mechanistic point of view.
Okay.
Because I think there's so many foods, and that's just such a simple model, but that's not as clinically efficient for people. So instead of giving the top five foods, we should be thinking, like, hey, eat some blueberries and have some fish oil. Let's not do that. Let's talk about mechanisms.
Okay.
So mechanisms that can really impact brain health, brain inflammation. Number one, gluten is one of them, and then also cross-reactivity to certain foods that are very similar to gluten. So I discussed that in the chapter. Another major cause of inflammation to the brain is insulin. Insulin is very, 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 very inflammatory. And as it relates to diet, if a person eats a meal and they get tired and they pass out, they just had an insulin surge.
Oh.
And the more insulin surges they have, the more aggressively they turn on these glial cells towards an inflammatory cascade. So instead of saying that there's a food that you should eat to dampen inflammation, which is to say you should not get tired and fatigued after each meal because you're changing the chemistry that now causes your brain to be inflamed.
Okay.
Okay. So that's I would say the two most common mechanisms that can impact things that cause brain inflammation. Anything that causes low oxygen to the brain and just any type of anemia. So going back to a dietary food model, anytime someone becomes, let's say, iron deficient anemic or B12 or folic acid anemic, the inability to carry oxygen to brain is going to cause the brain to actually not only degenerate but to become inflamed. That when the brain doesn't have oxygen, it can't drive its mitochondria. There's a chemical inflammatory reaction that takes place that degenerates the brain altogether. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Another inflammatory mechanism related to brain is just intestinal permeability itself, leaky gut.
Leaky gut.
And there's some studies associating leaky gut directly to brain-induced inflammation and depression. So any foods that are inflammatory that open up intestinal tight junctions, processed foods, casein, gluten, other types of things, can create an inflammatory consequence of the brain. So the simple model is, you know, eat more nuts, eat more seeds, eat more, you know, fish, eat some fish oil compounds, or you actually use fish oils, have some vegetables and fruits. But those are all simple models. But from a mechanistic point of view, gluten, insulin surges, intestinal permeabilities, anemias, they all cause severe inflammation to the brain, and they're all linked to diet and nutrition too.
Mm-hmm. Okay, before we go, what were some of your biggest misses on the thyroid? I mean, looking back 4 years, what have you learned in the last 4 years about the thyroid that you didn't know back then?
Well, we're constantly learning new things about the thyroid. But the fundamental concepts still have not changed, meaning that...
fundamentally, you still stand by your work.
Fundamentally, it's autoimmune, that 95% or more of hypothyroid people have Hashimoto's, and it's really an autoimmune-based thing. What we didn't know as much before when the brain book was released was gluten-free is not enough, and that there's cross-reactivity with certain foods. And sometimes we've missed looking at those foods as well. That's been one of the major key things that was missed. We talk about that in the brain book.
So, in other words, like you said, substituting quinoa or rice or something could still be a problem, Dr. Karazian, because you could have this cross-reactivity thing going on.
Exactly. And
wow.
For many thyroid patients, that wasn't covered in the first book, really going to the depth of those other mechanisms beyond just being gluten-free. Sometimes you go gluten-free and eat rice and quinoa and sesame and all these other things, but they react to those too. Has been one of the missed things that we've learned about since that book was written.
Is there a good, solid test to test for allergic foods and that it's worth the money?
Well, absolutely. I mean, we check for just your standard food sensitivities work. I personally like to do my testing with Thyrex. They check for the inflammatory foods that are important to us, and they check the cross-reactive grains, and we check gluten with all the different epitopes, and those are the key things.
Okay. Those are all blood tests.
Yeah.
And it's Thyrex Labs?
Yes, it's Thyrex Labs, CYREX Labs.
And where are they located?
They're in Arizona. Uh-huh. They have their webpage, people can check out.
Does that have to all go through a doc, or can people do direct, or how does it?
Well, at Thyrex Labs is a conventional medical lab. They will require to have blood samples drawn by a doctor that has a license to do the testing.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
I see. Well, you can just, these days, you can walk in, like in Austin, Texas, and get your blood drawn. Does that work?
Yeah, I mean, I think it depends. It's state by state based, and I think
sure. But as long as you can get blood to Cyrex, they'll do the deal.
Right.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for spending all this time with us. This is really a great book, folks. I've been looking through it the last week or so, and 600 pages, over 1,000 references. Took a long time to put this one together, Dr. Crossian, for you, right?
Yep. Several years, yeah.
Okay, the brain, and the website again is, well, let me get to it. What is it called? Brainhealthbook.com, Dr. Crossian.
Brainhealthbook.com.
Thanks a lot, Doc. We really appreciate
so
it.
Thank you.
Take care of yourself. Well, okay. Hope your head didn't explode with that one. But like this man, he does his research, boy. Very well respected around the world. Dottis Karazian. Get this book. It's going to be worth it. The Brain Health Book, brainhealthbook.com, or go through Amazon, click through One Radio Network. They'll give us 12 cents or something. It all adds up. Thank you. I love you all very much. Thanks to Sharon for everything. I love her, and I just gonna go do something else now. Take care.
Broadcasting from the beautiful Hill Country in Texas, this is OneRadioNetwork.com.